session number 16643, reel 2.
Commodore North Lewis, reel 2. What kind of introduction, welcome did you get in the squadron when you first joined it?
Well, I got a very good welcome with 175 Squadron. The squadron commander was Mike Inglefinch, who eventually succeeded me as wing leader of 124 Wing. But I was only with them for a month, and I was then posted to 182 Squadron. 182 Squadron. And there I again received a good welcome. There were just two flights in a Typhoon Squadron, and I was, I think, curiously enough, became the senior flight commander with the squadron.
Were your first operations in connection with the D-Day?
Yes, from when I joined the squadron, which was March 44, most of our operations were either against radar sites connected with the D-Day operations, or against Noble sites, which were the B-1 sites, or were diversionary operations up in the Pas-de-Calais to make the Germans think that this was where the invasion was going to take place. Most of the targets were coastal targets, which we attacked with our rockets.
What was it like attacking a radar station?
Well, like attacking any other site. We generally attacked from about 12 or 15,000 feet and released the rockets at a few hundred feet.
Were they hard to attack? To damage?
Yes, I think they were. A good number of the radar sites were severely damaged. I mean, if you hit them, then the 860-pound rockets did a great deal of damage.
And V-1 sites?
V-1 sites were very difficult because, to start with, it was very difficult to see what you were attacking. I mean, there was just a small concrete strip from which the V-1 was launched, plus the odd shed around it to house the equipment. Whether or not one did much damage to them, I don't know.
What other targets did you have?
Those were the main targets prior to D-Day, except for, as I said, the diversionary operations, which were kind of low-level sweeps up in the Pas-de-Calais to try and give the Germans the impression that the entire British Air Force was concentrating on that area.
Presumably with the V-1 sites, you didn't really know what they were at that time.
Oh yes, because the V-1s in 44 were winging their way across to London.
They started just after D-Day.
Oh, just after D-Day. Well, in that we knew that. Yes, you're right. We knew that they were going to be some type of missile site, and they were called Noble. I don't know why.
Did you operate on D-Day itself?
Yes, I led 182 Squadron to attack targets just inside France from the British beaches. But when we got over there, the clouds of smoke and haze and low cloud and what have you were such that I could not identify the target, and in fact we aborted and came back. So our initial attacks on D-Day were non-effective.
Did you see much of the force that was summoned to attack the Germans in Normandy?
Yes, I mean, we went over the whole of the Allied shipping. We were operating, as I said, from Hearn, which was directly across from Normandy, and so we flew over the Allied shipping in order to attack our targets. This became quite hazardous because one naval gunner would loose off at you and then the entire fleet would start firing at you, and later on I always deemed it was wiser to go over Cherbourg and in that way into the Normandy area, as it was a good bit safer.
What other operations did you take part in once Normandy had started?
Well, once they were ashore, our main job was ground support of the army, and we supported 21 Army Group, and most of the targets came from them. They would either give us gun positions or armor or what have you, and we came across and from the pinpoint they had given us, attacked whatever was there, or quite often you couldn't see what was there because often it was in, say, an artillery position in a corner of a wood. So one attacked the corner of the wood.
How well camouflaged was the German army?
Oh, very well camouflaged, and it was always very difficult to see the targets unless you caught them in the open.
And how much opposition did they put up to you as you went over?
Oh, tremendous operation. I mean, I can... it was mostly light ACAC. They had very effective multiple point fives. And as you went in, you were subjected to very, very heavy ACAC fire. The high-level stuff, the 88s, which fired at you when you were up at about 12,000 feet, on the whole, didn't do much damage, but it was the point fives, the low-level flak, which really was very effective. And, I mean, I can give you an example, for instance. I think... the Typhoon force for Normandy consisted of about 450 aircraft. During the 3 months of the Normandy operation, 150 pilots were killed, Typhoon pilots.
Were you hit yourself?
I was hit several times, but never... never brought down. I was got back. I mean, the aircraft was damaged on quite a number of occasions.
What kind of treatment did you expect should you be shot down and captured by them?
Well, one didn't really know. But having talked to a great number of Typhoon pilots since the war, I'm now quite certain that a number of those who were killed were shot by the SS Panzer forces.
After capture?
Yeah. That is really the only explanation that I can get for the very high percentage of people who were killed.
Do any strafing incidents in Norway stand out in your mind?
Well, I suppose the main one of which one remembers was the German attack, counter-attack at Mortain, when I was leading a squadron at the time, and I heard Charles Green, who was the Rhodesian wing leader of 121 wing, which was another of the 83 group Typhoon wings, call up to say that he had located a large number of German tanks at Mortain. I called him back and said, but this is inside the bomb line. And he said, they are definitely Germans. And I said, in that case, since you say so, we will come and attack them. And so Mortain, when a German armoured division was destroyed by the Typhoons and also by the American fighter bombers, was really the outstanding engagement, I think, of the Normandy campaign, with the possible exception, of course, of the slaughter done in the Falaise Gap, which, as you will recall, was when the British and American armies had more or less surrounded a large part of the German army at Falaise, and the air forces had a field day. Unfortunately, the gap was not entirely closed, and the Germans were managed to extricate a large proportion of their forces and retreat towards the Seine.
What did you see yourself at Mortain?
Well, one saw a large number of German armoured vehicles and tanks on the roads around Mortain, trying to advance, and they were all stationary on the roads, and so were in a kind of open target for the British and American aircraft.
So you must have had a field day.
Yes, it was. I mean, a large number of tanks were destroyed there. I mean, one, it's impossible to say how many one destroyed oneself, if any. I mean, you know, it is very difficult to see the result of your attack. You come down from 10, 12,000 feet in a steady dive, and about 500 feet you loose off 8 rockets at your target and then pull the stick hard back before you can see the rockets explode and get the hell out of it. And you kind of look back over your shoulder and hope to hell you hit something.
Did you see actual men?
Yes, you could see men, and you could see tanks and armoured vehicles and cars exploding. You know, it was one of the few times you saw everything in the open.
So what were the predominant feelings, of fear or exhilaration or what?
No, I don't think in most of the operations I took part in I ever actually experienced fear. In fact, I'm certain I'm not. Yes, exhilaration, I suppose. I've always thought that the Typhoon operations were like a good day's fox hunting with a bit of danger added to the mixture.
Did you also take part in the Falaise Gap operation?
Yes. I mean, I took part in all the operations because we were based by then on the 15th of June, I think it was, we went over to Normandy and operated from an airfield which had been bulldozed by the army at a place called Coulombe, B6 airfield on which the French now have put a granite memorial to 124 Wing on the site of the airfield.
How many attacks did you do at Falaise?
Oh, I couldn't say. I mean, I was flying sometimes 6 sorties a day during the intense period. I mean, there were periods after Normandy when one didn't fly all the time, but during the Normandy campaign, one flew a hell of a lot. They were all short trips. I mean, nothing more than about sometimes 45 minutes, because we were only about 10 minutes away from the battlefield. In fact, in one period we were shelled by the German artillery when we were on B6. Very close.
Did the German artillery have any effect?
No, it was quite frightening. That was frightening. No, they only did it once or twice, curiously enough. I don't know why they didn't do it more often.
What could you see of the plight of the German forces at Falaise?
Well, it was difficult, you know, to see all the... because the Falaise area was a big area. Most of the German forces were camouflaged or hidden in woods, or, as you know, the Bocage country, as it's called, is very narrow roads with high hedges on each side, which is why the 21 Army Group had such a job getting through. So what you saw in the short time of looking down was very limited. It wasn't like the kind of old-fashioned battles with armies laid out for everybody to see. I mean, there was very little to see, and during the actual attack, as I've said, you were diving down, concentrating on the target that you were going to shoot at, and then after it was all over, you were hell-bent on getting out before you too were shot down.
As far as the effect of the rockets on tanks were concerned, could the rockets actually move a tank bodily from the ground?
No. There's always been a considerable amount of controversy as to how effective the rockets were against the German Tiger tanks. And to a certain extent, there's been a kind of belittling of the Typhoon effectiveness against the tanks. But the Germans undoubtedly were extremely frightened of the Typhoon, and once attacked, generally got the hell out of it, even if they weren't destroyed. In the French view, having talked to the French when I'd been over in 1944 and again in 1994 and again in 1995, the French are convinced that the Typhoons won the Battle of Normandy. And it's because of this that the French have erected at Neuve-Bocage a magnificent memorial to the Typhoon pilots who were killed during the Normandy campaign. Most of the money for the memorial has been put up by the French. A certain amount has been put up by the Typhoon veterans. Except for a donation from the Australian government, neither the British government, the Royal Air Force, or the Canadian government have contributed.
What about the accuracy of the rocket fire from the point of view of hitting British or Allied troops?
Well, we operated outside a bomb line. A bomb line was given by the Army, and this was put on the operational maps in the briefing room, inside which you weren't allowed to attack. During a large part of the campaign, especially from Normandy onwards, we had our support units with the army who gave us often the targets to attack when we came up, and the army would put down coloured smoke to indicate the target they wanted attacked, and therefore you attacked the coloured smoke, which was often, as I've said, in the corners of woods where there was an artillery battery or something like that, and so the target was indicated to you. I think very rarely did we attack our own forces.
Now, after Normandy, what happened to the unit then?
Well, we moved with the advancing forces, first of all to just outside Paris, then to Amiens, and then to Brussels. In fact, I think I'm right in saying that I was the first British aircraft to land in Belgium, the first British aircraft to land in Holland, and I'm also believe I was the first British aircraft to land in Germany. This is because I went in to the advanced airfield first. But we moved very rapidly from Normandy, only spent a few days just outside Paris, just enough to allow me to go in, I think, the day after Paris was liberated. Then we moved up to Amiens again, very short time before we moved into Brussels, to Brussels Melsbrook, from where we operated for till Arnhem, when we moved to Eindhoven.
Was there any fighting still going on in Paris when you got there?
No, when I got there, I think it was when I went in, I think it was the day after the troops had taken Paris and the French had moved in. No one just had a night of liberation.
And the same in Brussels?
Brussels had, when I landed at Brussels Melsbrook, the ammunition dumps on the edge of the airfield were blowing up with the delayed fuses which the Germans had put in, and so the Germans had only just evacuated. I went in, I think, one day, and the wing came in the next day, and of course we were right on the outskirts of Brussels, so Brussels was a non-stop party. You fought all day and you had fun and games all night.
What did the fun and games consist of?
Oh, Brussels went wild. Brussels took a kind of fortnight's holiday. The entire population were on the streets, treating the liberators and so one had a really riotous time.
So you said you went up to Eindhoven. This was in support of Arnhem?
The British Army, as you know, went across the Albert Canal and advanced from Belgium up to Arnhem to try and join up with the paratroopers who had landed. We supported the Guards Armoured over the Albert Canal. In fact, when I was over the top of them, I saw the first six tanks of the Guards armoured go up in flames as they were hit by 88s firing down the road. We went down on the woods on each side of the road, and the Guards armoured were then able to advance straight on up the road. We then went in directly. Eindhoven had been liberated. We went into the airfield at Eindhoven, from whence we operated for the rest of the until at the beginning of 1945, when we moved to Helmond for the crossing of the Rhine.
New Year's Day 1945 was supposed to have been the last fling of the German Air Force.
Very much so.
Do you remember what happened to you on that day?
Yes, I was had gone up in the early morning to brief two squadrons we had sent off on operations, and I was looking out of the window of the operations room when I saw some aircraft circling the airfield, and much to my surprise I recognised 190s and 109s, and we were then subjected for about 20 minutes to constant attacks on the squadrons located at Eindhoven. There were no less than three wings at Eindhoven. There was my wing of four squadrons, there was a Canadian wing of Typhoons, and there was a reconnaissance wing of Spitfires, I think, and Mustangs, it may have been, I can't remember. So there were a large number of aircraft at Eindhoven, and a large number were destroyed, and it was absolute chaos.
Did it take you by surprise that they had such strength?
Took me totally by surprise. Fortunately, my wing were well dispersed, and although we lost a number of aircraft and had one or two people killed, we didn't suffer as badly as the Canadian wing, which were all drawn up in lines and lost a great number of aircraft. However, it was all soon put right, and we were soon back to a reasonable strength, and life went on as before.
Now, can we come on to the March 1945 Rhine crossing? And can you tell me what...
Yes, could we just go back?
Certainly.
Because one of the great operations was just prior to the 1st of January, was the Ardennes operation, which, as you know, the Germans attempted to break through at Ardennes and drive towards Brussels. And as one soldier so pithily put it to me, he said he could see little difference between December 1944 and whenever it was, the German breakthrough in 1940, except this time we didn't hold Dunkirk, as we hadn't liberated Dunkirk. However, the first few days of the German operation, when they made their major advances, the weather was absolutely filthy, and we could not operate at all. However, round about just after Christmas, the weather